The topic of today's presentation is what I'm looking to do is examine our first principle. That being that we covenant to affirm and promote the inherent worth and dignity of every person. And I would propose to read into that first principle without exception to the end of it. And I'd like to just, as I say, go into and examine that. So again, I intend to examine what seems to be a very fundamental and uncomplicated principle. And again, to do this, I intend to add the words without exception to the first principle. It is this context that I wanted to examine what happens when we examine this principle closely and drill into it a little bit deeper. In this presentation, I want to acknowledge the work of Reverend Nathan Walker, a Unitarian Universalist minister working at the Newseum Center for Religious Freedom in Washington, D.C., and in his book, Cultivating Empathy, The Worth of Every Person, Without Exception. That was inspired by Reverend Walker's work, and I will again quote him extensively in my presentation. In preparing this presentation for this morning, I encountered many questions and rather few answers. Rather Unitarian, I thought. I also realized that I have some definite opinions on various aspects of this topic, also characteristically Unitarian, certainly in my experience in any event. The origin of this first principle would seem to be similar to that of most other religious tracts, from the Council of Nicaea to the Working Group on Relations at the Regina Unitarian Fellowship. It represents the work of a committee, with the text and interpretation of same having been refined over time in accordance with changing social norms. I think that few present would take issue with the proposition that this principle stands to oppose discrimination on the basis of such factors as race, national origin, creed, age, gender or gender identity, and sexual orientation. If we were to leave it there, I would suggest that we'd have little to discuss and might consider taking the coffee hour early this morning. What I'd like to do first, however, is parse this principle somewhat and examine the issue of what is meant by the worth of every person. What's meant by that? And what does that mean to you? Does it mean that the worth of any or every person to society, is that what that means? Does it mean the worth of any or every person to humankind? Does it mean the worth of any or every person to this planet Earth? It seems to me that there can be little debate about the value or the worth, if you want, of great thinkers who contributed to philosophy, advances in mathematics, science, literature, and the arts. Likewise, there is likely to be few dissenters as to the value or worth of great humanitarians, Mother Teresa, Albert Schweitzer, our own Lotta Hitchmanova, and Stephen Lewis come to mind particularly. It may be argued that persons responsible for the great advances in technology and economic development may add significant value or worth from a societal perspective. Undoubtedly, great environmentalists ought to be included. David Suzuki, of course, comes first to mind. Workers who make our lives comfortable and possible include farmers, other producers, those who build and maintain civic infrastructure, as well as many others who contribute significantly to the well-being of our society and all of its individuals. What then of those who are unable, for some reason, to contribute significantly and in a tangible way to society? Does one have to earn the right to be considered of value or worthy? Does one have to earn the right to be considered of value or worthy? Can a person cease to be valuable or worthy? Or what of those who have chosen not to participate or contribute tangibly to the community? Can it be argued that their worth is less or, frankly, potentially negative? More particularly, I would want to discuss the case of those persons or groups of persons who have done destructive or antisocial acts. For instance, what about those responsible for the Holocaust? What about those responsible for the Rwandan genocide or similar acts both before and after? Joseph Stalin, for instance, comes to mind specifically. And what about those who participated in same? How do we view such persons as Jim Jones, Robert Picton, Clifford Olson, Paul Bernardo, Inderjit Singh Rayat, all responsible for multiple killings? What's our stance upon the worth and dignity of those persons? How do we view those persons or groups which espouse philosophies, and some may put them into action, which are directly at odds with ours? I think of the Ku Klux Klan, the Taliban, ISIS, Boko Haram, other political or religious movements with which we differ. Do we demonize, isolate, or just generally look down the end of our noses at such general evil or stupidity? From a Christian perspective, we might refer to Luke 23:34, wherein the writer quotes some of Jesus' final words as, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." In his book that I referred to earlier, Reconciliation Ministry, or pardon me, in his book Reconciliation Ministry, Mission and Ministry in Changing Social Order, Robert Reiter argued that barbaric acts are made possible when we otherize other persons or groups. He wrote, "We can demonize the other, treating the other as someone to be feared and eliminated if possible. We can, on the other hand, romanticize the other, treating the other as far superior to ourselves. We can colonize the other, treating the other as inferior. We can generalize the other, treating the other as a non-individual. We can trivialize the other by ignoring what makes the other disturbingly different. We can homogenize the other by claiming that there's really no difference. Or we can vaporize the other by refusing to acknowledge the presence of the other at all." I can provide my personal experience of working closely with clients who have committed terrible violent acts and with those who have intentionally killed others. While the acts are horrendous, often the individual perpetrators are persons with whom I found it quite easy to maintain a pleasant professional relationship. That's my personal experience. And again, I'll get back to Reverend Walker in terms of, and in reflecting on our attitudes to others with whom we disagree, sometimes vehemently. He said in a sermon that he delivered in Philadelphia, and I quote, "We, as one strong body, are required to lead by being. When we feel the impulse to be the interrogator, we must choose to be the generator of visions larger than ourselves. When we feel the impulse to be enraged, we must accept the invitation to be empathetic and no longer make people the object of our aggression. When we feel the impulse to be furious, let us dare to be curious. When we feel the impulse to be righteous, let us transform our soapbox into a music box. Let us dare to be powerfully playful. And again, later in that same address, he says, what does justice making look like, feel like, when we receive hostile communications? Are we hostile in return? Or is something else required of us? What we choose to do is a reflection of who we believe ourselves to be. It all depends on our beliefs about power. I once believed that it was powerful to condemn wrongdoers, said Walker. I believed it right to tear down another's unexamined assumptions and to vaporize those whose presence was not worthy of my attention. I believed that others were the cause of my aggression. Others were to blame for my feelings of despair, disappointment, and righteous indignation. Rather than anger serving as a signal that something was wrong, anger became the solution to all my problems. It felt good to find the addiction of righteousness. I was doing justice. I was doing justice. All the while being an ass. I've spent far too much energy using the public forums as a battlefield. I've spent far too much energy using public forums to annihilate those I perceive to be my enemy, wrote Walker. I have armed myself with faithful friends so that each time we walked into a room, those presence would shade their gaze and whisper in dread, "The liberals have arrived." I used to believe that being feared was powerful. I used to believe that it was my duty to free the oppressed. But when I react with righteous anger, I become the oppressor. Again, in Reverend Walker's further in his book, he makes the following observation. Many of us know intellectually that we must do more than just advocate for justice. We must also emotionally intuit that there is something deeper, and we long for a new way of being. However, we have to make the collective effort to first know what that something is and learn to practice it on a daily basis. I believe, wrote Walker, that the something is the moral imagination. It is compassion in action. It is leading by being kind and empathetic. It is a vision for using conflicts as opportunities for intimacy and mutual understanding. I know that liberals aspire to be known as people who are truly kind, but unfortunately, we have allowed ourselves to be seen as irritable and inflexible, as liberal fundamentalists. I'd like to circle back then to the question as I first posed it this morning. Is it possible to interpret our first principle, adding the words "without exception" following? And I guess here is where I come to my opinion. The question that I pose is somewhat rhetorical. Again, I would say I wonder whether the better question to be posed is, how will the answer to that question reflect upon us? I expect that there may be questions and comments, and I would invite them now. I think Jim has a mic.
Okay.
It has always troubled me that we tend to look at other people as a source of evil and malicious behavior, when I think I've discovered the enemy and they are us. And you look at what we did in World War II with the bombing of 60 cities in Germany and Japan. We purposely and deliberately tried to kill as many women and children as we could. Our message to the Japs and the Germans was our new technology, the Firestorm and later the A-bomb, enables us to kill, hold your women and children as hostages, and we will kill them by the tens of thousands until such time as you unconditionally surrender. You look at Eisenhower, who murdered close to a million Axis POWs after the war, most of them after the war. Nobody knows about these things. These are the things we close our eyes to, and yet we like to look at many of the people that you've mentioned there. Oh, and then we look at our behavior today in Syria and Iraq and what we've done to those people. It's just incomprehensible to me. But anyway, I just have to... I've discovered the enemy, and they are us.
You may know this, Amy, but I think at one stage the word inherent was inserted into that statement, which I think makes it easier to handle, because unless we believe in original sin, you know, we realize that people come into this world, a lot of people become very damaged, do terrible things, but inherent makes quite a difference to being able to accept that first statement.
I think so. Certainly, that's what I mean. I would argue that we have difficulty in terms of throwing rocks at others.
Hi, Jamie. Thank you for a very thoughtful presentation. I just wonder about cases in point. Most recently in Ottawa yesterday. When there were those anti-immigrant demonstrations right on Parliament Hill, and how should we react to people like that? Shall we just let it go on because they have inherent dignity and worth without exception? Or can we peacefully confront them? Unfortunately, that doesn't seem possible. So, you know, you do so at risk of your own life or others around you. And the same problem in, I forget where it was in the States, the hard right people. Also the Proud Boys who challenged the Indians in the Maritimes who were the indigenous people who were having a ceremony. It's something that I can't solve in my own mind. Could you do it, please?
And we'll have lunch later. I think that's fair. I don't think what Walker is suggesting is that we simply withdraw from the field of public discourse. And again, certainly that's not something that I would advocate either. I think that what he's calling for is a sort of a thoughtful approach, and that we need to be careful in terms of the language used and that certainly dialogue is going to outweigh shouting at each other, if I can put it that way.
Yeah, I would say the size of the rocks
Sal.
Jamie, I'm not sure if I've got the right spot here. Some here may remember the presentation I gave on January 2009 called Intolerance as a Virtue, a Challenge to the First Principle, where I was trying to make the statement contrary to your without exception that there are indeed exceptions, and you referred to a number of them in your presentation. there are people and situations which we just can't tolerate and acknowledge as being worthy and dignified. I guess everybody, as they're born, has an inherent ability, but they're a result of or of their raised, you know, how they're brought up and the culture that they exist in, and there is a lot of evil in the world that we have to contend with, and we can't let it go by.
So I was humbled by a YouTube video I just happened to come across yesterday. And it was a woman from Auschwitz that was a twin. So she was actually part of the Mengele twin experiments. And she talked about how her family was all kind of basically all taken away from the first few minutes when they got there. She and her sister, as there were children, were taken separate because of them being twins. And then she talked about what was done to them, which, of course, if you know anything about that history, was pretty awful. And then she's talking now as a grown-up who's gone through, had children, grandchildren. She made a choice to really think about this and to think about forgiveness. And she thought, well, who does she have to forgive? And she decided that she would work through the process of forgiving a Nazi doctor that she knew was still alive. She eventually communicated with that doctor, and over time, then they actually went to, I think it was the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz, and she got a document from him testifying what sort of thing he did, of how he, when there was a gassing, it wasn't a death certificate for the whole each person, it was just the count. It was however many were killed in that particular gassing. So she went on and was able to forgive this doctor. And it actually really helped her to be going through that process. But what she realized is the person that she still had trouble with was Dr. Mengele's. And she said she went home at one point. She looked up in the dictionary, she said, I don't know why 24, but I think she said 24 bad words. And she said those all, I guess, out loud in her house or apartment. And then she was able to go through the process of actually forgiving Dr. Mengele's for something that was obviously, if we're going to be talking about pretty horrific things, he would be near the top.
Thank you, Jamie. This was really interesting and really challenging. I once heard a debate that was highlighting the individual and the worth and dignity of individuals and how it was important to respect that always. And the other person was talking about why that we have to stop certain things that happen that are going on, and certain people are doing things or have done things, and the treatment of those people and those situations was separated in this debate, so that you had to hold the two things in mind at the same time. That if you're punishing people for doing wrong things or preventing them from doing wrong things, you can still respect the fact that they have an individual spirit that has value, but you still don't allow them to do the wrong things. So keeping those in mind at the same time seems to be a challenge. It seems to be worth addressing.
Thank you.
I'm trying to keep everybody in order here.
Thank you, Jim. This follows on a bit from what Joe said. Wen and I were recently on a holiday, and we sat at a table, six people on a ship. We sat at a table each night with people from the U.S. And since we've come home, we've told a couple of people, imagine there were six people there that voted for Trump. And then I thought to myself, those Southern Baptists, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then I said to myself, hold on a minute here. I'm doing the exact thing that I criticize them for. I am generalizing about people because they said they're from the Baptist Church or because they voted for Trump. And so I think, you know, Sandra says, how on earth can we do anything or deal with this idea of without exception? And I think all, what we can do as individuals is demonstrate and live the behavior that we believe to be right. We demonstrate the love, we demonstrate the respect for all people, as the individual people. We may not like some things about institutions, but the individuals, I want to try so hard not to be judgmental of people because of a label.
We got lots of time here.
Thanks, Jamie. This is interesting. I actually just saw two TED Talks, actually, that kind of reflected on this stuff. And so it was from, both were from the same professor, and he was talking about in universities right now, when he did a show of hands, who felt they were more left-leaning and who felt they were more right-leaning. It was like 80-90% of the people in universities are all left-leaning. And he says there's a danger in this because it's creating one set of ideas of thinking and not understanding the other ideas. And it's going to cause trouble down the line as we go further in history here. And then another one he talked about was about how we're kind of born, or he believes from his studies that we're born with basically five moral traits. And as we grow up and our experiences in life, we tend to become more left and right, but basically certain parts of those morals, left people value more and right people value another set more. But the problem is, as we go more left and right, we create this us against them, and that causes lots of conflict in the world. And he believes we should be more looking at Eastern philosophies, which kind of value both of them, the yin and the yang. They're not a thus or us against them. It's a togetherness, and both have something that can help each other to create a better result when it comes to issues.
Well, if I could just respond very briefly. Again, I would generally agree with you in terms of if we are talking to ourselves, if we are talking to like-minded people, and we can all pat ourselves on the back in terms of how moral and how right we are about everything we believe and do. And if that dialogue is not going on with the people that we don't agree with, the people that we may really have difficulties with in terms of their philosophies, in terms of what they do, the question is, what do we achieve? That would be from you. That's what I would. That would be my position in any event.
It's true that we do have to confront a lot of evil in the world. And as individuals, we have to make a choice about how we're going to deal with it. I'm thinking of Gandhi and the choices that he made. He was very active, and I believe that that is very important for us. We do have to be active. We do have to stand up for what our values are. But there are ways that we can do it nonviolently. So we still hold respect for the people who think and act differently than we do, but we stand up for what we believe in a nonviolent and caring way. Another example is Nelson Mandela. We all know that South Africa could have been a bloodbath, and it wasn't, because of Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela.
I do some work with Amnesty, and it's an interesting organization because on the one hand, you're writing letters to various governments who are imprisoning and, you know, otherwise, you know, ruining their countries, hurting people and so forth. And on the other hand, you can have opportunities to meet with people and talk about issues. They call it desk, being on a desk somewhere. And yesterday I was in North Central. They had a street fair, and I met a guy who had an interesting story. He'd been in prison for about 25 years. He was confined to a wheelchair and a scooter, and we were talking about the effect of government cuts on his life in Saskatchewan and how his income had been shrunk down to $900 a month, spending money. That's food and stuff like that, not shelter. And I once again realized the importance of government policy on people's lives and on their abilities to even have any respect. This guy had been in prison. He was talking about the conditions in prison to some degree and about how we basically throw them in prison and forget them. And then we cut back services, like prisoners are now getting $1 a day spending money instead of $2. They can't even afford a phone call in Saskatchewan. Government policy makes a difference, not just in Uzbekistan or Iran, but here in good old Canada, here in Saskatchewan. So here's my point. Government policy is in our hands. And so it is individual interaction, but it's also that, at least that level of interaction in terms of how we relate to government policy. Yeah. I could say more, but that's good for now.
I'm sorry for taking a second turn. I thought everybody else had finished. But as you were speaking, I was thinking about, I've been thinking a lot about Indigenous people and the issues in Canada that are present right now. And I was thinking that one of the things I didn't hear you mention was poverty and not much about the Indigenous people. And when we were talking about the huge criminals and of the world who've been... Lose my... Okay. In mass murders, I just couldn't help but think, yeah, and we stand... We have a government that has restitution to make for actually being involved in these things, too. And like many of our services, there is an everyday present and current application. Pardon? This is it. Like, we can do something now, and it has to do with governments and policies and our daily behavior and those sorts of things. So I just was in terms of what we're doing here and now.
That's very valid.
It's just... Yes, David wants to have a word here. I'll get to you, honest. We got time.
I hesitate to say anything, but in about 1970 in the United States, a person who later was on the Supreme Court of the U.S. decided that things were going 100% wrong for the upper class, and he wrote a letter to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and in his mind warned them about what was happening. Well, since that time, the right has made a concerted effort to control the message in the media, to use their money in such a way that the message is proper from their perspective. They have decided to put huge amount of money into who gets elected, and they've been very effective that way. They've been hugely effective in determining what legislation comes forward, not only in Washington, but in each of the states. So if we're talking about the yin and the yang, you have to realize that one of the parts is hugely successful just on the basis of big money. So we can't keep our mind off that fact, not only there, but to some extent in Canada and certainly in the world. So I don't think we need to be comfortable in saying, let's be considerate of both sides. We can't be.
I think we'll take two more. I'm going to give it to Carol first and then Richard. Okay, and then I think that's it. Sorry if I'm cutting anybody off here.
Thank you, Jamie. Everybody, their comments about, particularly Pam, directing our attention to the inherent worth. I thought that helped to clarify some of my thinking. Does this, leaving movements and politics aside, does this beg the question at the individual level of the medical model, substituting psychopathy for evil?
Well, that's interesting. I hadn't considered that particularly. Again, it seems to me that, and I'll speak from my personal experience in terms of dealing with folks, and this is what I do for a living is I spend time with people who have committed a lot of sort of really heinous and violent crimes. And it's almost never that you have sort of a single dimension in terms of a person. There's always a story. There's always more to that individual. It is something. If I thought that that each of these people was just sort of evil to the core, it'd be much more difficult to do what I do. But as I say, it is seldom that I come to that opinion about someone. There are the acts that they commit, and there is the person. As I say, they're very seldom just of one sort of plane, if I could put it that way.
But there's the idea that is very very widely accepted that psychopathy is hardwired into certain people. And I wonder if that means anything. Put it close to me. Eat the thing. Just never mind. That's the point that I wanted to make. If they're hardwired to be completely outside of any making ever any contribution but totally destructive, I have a little trouble with it. But then I have my own spiritual advisor, Father Brown. Does anybody want? I have to go back to Father Brown and learn that whatever people do, they are still possible of redemption.
Okay. So, Richard, and then we're done.
The last word. Yeah.
This whole topic reminds me of the universalist who says we're all eligible for salvation, but many of us are going to fall by the wayside, and the Unitarian who says we're all going to hell, but some of us are working our way out of it.
The last word.